The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Oh, good morning, everyone. And I'm very happy to be here with you all. And some of that happiness is being with all of you, but some of it is carrying with me from my last 3 weeks that I was at the Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. And it's probably the oldest Buddhist monastery in the country. And when it started in 1967, it was kind of revolutionary because it was co-ed, which was very, very unusual to have men and women practicing together more or less as equals. I think that equality improved over the decades. And I trained there. I began my training there. I spent about 3 years there, and I started 43 years ago in 1980. And so I went back, and really went back the first time to be a Zen teacher there, more or less. I've been back as a visitor for over these years, but to go back into my original kind of Zen training monastery where I was really formed in many ways in Buddhism in my training at that monastery. And so to be back there, not only to be back in the place, and but to be back there practicing, and it was a practice event for 3 weeks, a practice period. And to be practicing there, where all these memories would come back. Well, I was standing there when that happened, and that happened over here, and in the meditation halls, knowing these different spots that were so significant for me. I went around and visited them and bowed to them. Because, oh yeah, this is where I sat when this happened, or this and that. And it was quite... but I think one of the very interesting, at least for me, occurrences of being there was to realize how long I've been doing this Buddhist practice. I've been involved now for 50 years. And and that's long enough to have an overview of what happens to a person doing Buddhist practice for 50 years. Not just what happens on one retreat or one meditation session, but what happens over the decades. What happened in that decade, in that decade, and it felt kind of natural, it's kind of spontaneous being there to kind of have an overview of this life that I've had in Buddhist practice. And it might be interesting to hear a little bit of it, not so much because me, but because to appreciate the way in which Buddhist practice works on people. Because there, and the highlight for me was not so much was about this, is that it works in ways that you don't see at the time. That there's a way in which things change gradually over years, and then in retrospect you look back and say, oh yeah, look at that. I had no idea. I thought I was doing X. But really, the universe was doing Y for me. You know, the Dharma, the practice was... And Y is what flowered, not X. I was distracted by my... what I thought was important in the moment, what my plans were, what my expectation, what the agendas I have, to notice that something different was happening. And I would say some of the profound ways that I've been changed by the Dharma, I didn't foresee. I didn't see them coming. I didn't see them happening as they were happening. They happened gradually, and in retrospect, oh, that's what happened. So I wanted to, that might be nice for me to talk to you about this, and as a part of this introduction also is to say that the Dharma practice, this Buddhist practice, mindfulness practice, works in three time frames. It works in the immediate present, it works in the short term, and it works in the long term. It has ways in which it unfolds. And it's important to appreciate all three. Because if you only think it happens over the long term, you might mess up the long term because you're straining and trying to, working for some change that's going to happen in the mythic future, and you're missing the present. And if you're only seeing the benefits of the present, you might not really allow yourself to give yourself over fully to the practice so that the long-term benefits can flower and develop over time. To have some sense of the possibility of what this, where we're going, is also important. And so this combination of the cherishing and loving the practice in the moment and valuing what happens, and also valuing what happens over time. And in the moment, you know, just as we're practicing it, even sitting here meditating with you, you could feel sometimes that the moment of mindfulness, it doesn't have to be more than a moment, is that when mindfulness is clear, there's a kind of lightening up, a kind of opening up, a kind of calming or spaciousness. I like to call it the breathing room. Suddenly there's a breathing room for this, what's happening now. Some people will talk a lot about mindfulness being kind of a pause, and if that's the case, I like to think of it as a sacred pause. And it's a pause that just long enough to check in and feel, know, experience what's the present moment experience is like. And that movement of attention to the present moment that has some higher quality than ordinary distracted attention is very different than most people live their lives. Many people are mostly distracted, mostly running around. My wife just told me, she read a newspaper article, I think this morning or yesterday, about why attendance in churches are going down. And one reason, many reasons, I suppose, but one is that among young people, is they're just so busy. So Sunday morning, you're not going to go to church on Sunday morning when you want to spend time finally with your friends because you've been working and overworking and doing all kinds of things. And so this idea of taking time and not to feel and sense and stop, to have a higher quality attention to what's happening in this moment, and then discovering, lo and behold, it feels really good. Lo and behold, it feels better than some of the alternatives. And one of the alternatives is to rush off and do things half-heartedly or distractedly. One of the great things that's part of, I think, modern life is to do things efficiently. And even better, not only efficiently, but do things, multiple things at the same time efficiently. And just, you know, so you can do more and more things. And one of the really big disappointments I have for you about mindfulness practice and Buddhist practice is that it is not efficient. So if that's what you're into, this is probably not for you. And, you know, if it was efficient, you would come to IMC and say, why are we sitting 35 minutes? I can nail that meditation in 10 minutes. And then you go off and do the important things. But they're really big in appreciating something really precious and how in some ways the precious and wonderful experience of being alive, even with the great challenges of life, even the tragedies of life, there's something about really knowing how to be present for it in a full way, even present for a broken heart, even present as we cry, that there's something that's invaluable and kind of to be cherished or valued. And one of the ways to value it is to realize for yourself that just about all the alternatives to being really mindful and present for go through life, it's not a better alternative than mindfulness. If you know of a better alternative than being mindful, then probably you should go ahead and do it. But I say that with some confidence because with time you realize this is the best alternative to really be here and present in a good way. And that the rewards of that can be instantaneous, just right here. It feels good. And that's my hope for all of you, is that you will learn enough about mindfulness to feel the instantaneous rewards, the benefits. Oh, this is good. I'm glad I had that moment to be present. I don't regret it. As opposed to, I could have been on Amazon. So this practice works in the moment. It also works in the short term. And some of you might have experienced this just in this meditation session we had, that maybe you're a bit, because you sat here long enough, maybe something settled in you. Maybe you're a little bit calmer. Maybe your mind slowed down. Maybe it took a while for the busyness of the mind to stop and quiet down enough so you can feel connected here and feel like you're showing up here. It could be that you carried a lot of tension with you that you didn't even know, stress of the week or the day. And this was long enough to let that be dissipate, partly because, not because necessarily you were brilliant at being mindful, but you just stopped. You stopped running around, stopped checking your devices, stopped kind of, you know, and just being still for a while. There is a kind of progression of letting go and relaxing that is invaluable for people. And if you add to that recipe mindfulness, attention, concentration, compassion, kindness, there's all kinds of wonderful things can happen in a period of meditation, or can happen in, over a week of regular practice, or going on a meditation retreat. It's remarkable that most people who go on a week-long retreat will see it as a journey. This thing unfolds over time. And not a few people want to leave after the first day. If we advertised what the retreat was about based on what happens the first day, no one would come. But it's a little bit like, you know, when I had a running practice that I started up at the monastery, and it was the place where I'd run was up this 5-mile road. Eventually, I got it to the top, but we just slowly over the long time kind of get better and better. But I remember I would start up the road, and probably the first 300 yards, it felt like every cell in my body was screaming at me, "Stop!" I hated it. It was horrible. And then something kicked in and it got into the flow. And after a while, it felt like, you know, after I did for a while, trained for a while, it just felt like it was just delight to run and kind of like the body ran itself and until I, you know, got winded or something. But it was really nice. So a little bit like that happens on retreats too, that there's a transition, acclimating, getting attuned, letting go of the tensions of our life, having to resolve some of being surprised by all the unresolved issues in our life that suddenly appear that you've been overlooking or distracted from and having to work through them. So the transition that first day is really an invaluable and important thing to go through. But it's often challenging for people. And then things settle down sometimes. And I don't want to make any promises. And they settle down, and usually by at some point, the retreat people feel so happy to be present and alive and calm, and there's a clarity of vision. People start to go outside, and it's lovely to watch people go outside of the retreat center to be outdoors in the property. After about day 4, and they're just like marveling at the trees and the flowers and just sitting having a tea as if the cup of tea is their long lost friend they're so happy to see and be with, and they're just really there for that cup. It sounds maybe a little silly to live that way, but it's just such a, you know, to have that level of calmness and that level of presence and that level of undistractedness and that level of non-compulsion that we often live with is phenomenal. So this, you know, it takes some days, and sometimes the longer the retreat, the deeper the process goes, the fuller this transformation can happen. So there's this change that happens over time. And on retreats, for example, in a daily meditation practice you might do, there is a kind of change that happens over a day, or over a particular session, over a week or something. But often, some of the most obvious benefits from that disappear once you get to work, once you start up, once you get back to your usual life. And sometimes it disappears in a few minutes, sometimes in a few days. But there's also the changes that happen that are enduring. But that those tend to be incremental over time. And often they're so incremental you don't see them. And the analogy that I've used sometimes is that when I lived in Hawaii for 2 years, when I first got there, it'd be a nice sunny day, like no clouds in the sky, and you know, you wear a t-shirt and shorts, you know, and you certainly don't go around with an umbrella there because it's sunny, warm, hot. And then they would suddenly, out of nowhere, there'd be this torrential downpour. And so I did what everywhere else I lived in the world you do, is you run for cover. And I very quickly learned you don't have to do that in Hawaii. You just let yourself get drenched, and then 5 minutes later, you're all dried out again. The sun's come out again, so the drenching doesn't last very long. Where I was born in Norway, the town is called Bergen. It's surrounded by mountains on three sides and the ocean on the fourth. And the saying there is that it rains 360 days of the year, and the other 5 days it's cloudy. It isn't quite as bad as that, but the local newspaper used to have on the front page a tally of how many sunny days there's been every year. Every day of the year, so you're adding up over the course of the year. Started zero on January 1st. And so, there was a lot of all kinds of rain, but there was often a misty rain, light, misty rain. And I would walk through the town, it was so light that you didn't really feel it getting wet at first. But if you're walking far enough, it got totally soaked and drenched. And because it was cold, it would be really cold. So it snuck up on you. So a little bit if you're generous to the analogies. Going on a week-long retreat is like getting drenched. and then it dries out kind of quickly. But if you meditate every day, or if you go on retreats often, or if you live in a monastery and you're practicing kind of all the time, it's a little bit like being in the fog or in the mist, and you're slowly getting wet, but you don't get cold, and your heart just warms more and more as you get this kind of dharma mist coming, soaking up, and slowly something begins happening, but you don't see it happening, and so over years, over decades that I can speak of now. It's kind of remarkable I can speak about decades. It's kind of snuck up on me. I can see there have been phases and changes that happen over, big chunks of time. And it speaks to a little bit the natural process of change, that you put together the right conditions, that there's something that begins happening within that's kind of natural, because I wasn't trying to do this or attempting to do these kinds of changes. Somehow the psychophysical system that we are has capacities for changing in beneficial ways, growing in certain ways that sometimes we don't realize. Our society hasn't taught us that this is a possibility, perhaps. So I want to share with you three phases over this time that were very significant for me. And the first phase was when I first came to Zen practice, kind of the Zen practice phase. And I was new to practice then. And as is true for many people, I came to the practice because I suffered. And I thought that, I tried different things and I didn't know anything else to do for my suffering, but to try to, I'd been introduced to Zen practice a little bit. And I said, okay, this is kind of what I thought would maybe make a difference for me. And in fact, when I sat, meditated, and did retreats at the Zen Center, that's one of the things that came to the forefront was my suffering and some of the deeper ways in which my mind, my heart worked that accentuated or was the cause, the operating principles for my suffering. So, for example, I had a lot of self-criticism. I had a lot of guilt. I mean, not just necessarily I'd done anything wrong. I felt guilty how I walked across the meditation hall floor. I was probably walking across the floor the wrong way. You know, just anything, you know, I was doing it the wrong way and I was somehow inherently wrong. And it was kind of a big burden. And the fear of rejection and all my fears that I had. And so I would sit and meditate, and these would, part of the benefit and the horror of practice is you get to see your mind well. Wow, like, look at that. This is bad. You know, I had no idea. But it's really good to see it. Because then we can take an honest assessment. We can see it clearly enough that we don't give into it. We learn to find alternatives. We learn to heal it. So for me, because in Zen practice they give very little instruction, except sit, sit still and be still and don't move and just be with whatever's happening. They didn't tell me what to do about the suffering, except what I understood, just be with it. So I did add a little extra instructions to myself, and that was to unconditionally accept whatever was happening. So I was practicing unconditional acceptance, not of the suffering, but of being present for it, just being with it and being with it. And that was a tenderizing process, kind of like tenderizing meat. Something began to soften in me. And I didn't see it happening. I didn't recognize that it was happening. When it began happening, I was projecting what my needs were into the world. And the need I have in the contact with my suffering, this tenderizing that was happening, was compassion. And I started first being very strongly drawn to images of compassion. Some of them was the images of the Mahayana, the Japanese images of the great Bodhisattva, the archetype of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, Kannon, Kuan Yin. And I started collecting photographs and pictures of Kuan Yin and putting them on my wall. I started drawing copies of them. And I just thought it was a nice thing to do to have these. I didn't think about what I was doing. I didn't think, wow, you're really collecting all these pictures of compassion. And then I would project compassion onto people that I saw. Sometimes I would say, well, that person is so compassionate. People would look at me, you got to be kidding. But for me, they were. It was, you know, and I know that some of it was projection, because at the Zen Center, they had a statue that for many years, I didn't know what the title of the statue was, or the artwork. It was about 5 feet tall. And you'd see it when you came up from the meditation in the basement. You'd come up the steps and be directly in front of me back then, directly on top of the steps, right in front of you. You have to walk towards it. It was kind of sinewy. And it looked a little bit like a very abstract kind of person, about the size of a person, and maybe kind of the narrowness of a person going up. And it was very, very, not sensuous, but very flowing, beautiful flowing, almost like it had robes that were flowing. And I thought that it was this archetype of compassion, Kannon, Avalokiteshvara. And I just would come up from meditation and be so moved to see her standing there, receiving me. Many years later, I found out that the artist thought he was carving a flame. And that's the title, Flame, Fire. I guess it was a projection that I had. And also I would feel that the wind sometimes blowing against my cheek, I was being stroked by compassion. It probably was a projection. You know, so I was looking for and needing to receive compassion in all kinds of ways. And I did encounter compassionate people at the Zen Center who, in times of my distress, it was so impressed me. It made such a big difference on me to feel and be with them. And so eventually, looking back over my time at Zen Center, I saw that I didn't become enlightened. I became compassionate. And my sense of my capacity for compassion grew and grew steadily until near the end of my time at Zen Center, I made a commitment, a vow, as part of the being ordained as a priest, as a monk there, that I was going to dedicate my life to the compassionate service to the world, to the suffering of the world. I wanted to somehow, I'd met my own suffering, and now I wanted to meet and support others, the world, to not suffer. So compassion became like the operating principle for how I was going to organize my life and live my life. And that's kind of what brought me here, you know, to IMC, to you today, that momentum of that choice to live from compassion, and you know, that was huge. So after my phase at the San Francisco Zen Center, I found myself somewhat by coincidence, by not exactly by plan, in a monastery that taught Vipassana, insight meditation in Thailand. And that opened the door for me to continue with that this practice that we do here. And I was pretty happy doing the practice. And I did the practice in Asia first. And then I came back to do here, and I did it at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, kind of the earliest big center in our tradition. And I did a three-month retreat there. And I was kind of shocked or stunned when I got there to practice the first time in Western settings with just Western teachers. Because, and it's part of my surprise, because I came from Zen, which is serious. And just direct pointing to emptiness and the truth, and, you know, and being kind of disciplined and stoic, and you're like, you know, you know, you're supposed to go, And in fact, when I practiced Zen, I had an I would sit there, I have this class, I wasn't trying to do it, but maybe because of the attitude that comes along, this upside down smile. So then I came to you know, these Vipassana insight teachers in Massachusetts, and they did this surprising thing. They did a guided meditation on loving kindness. Oh my God. I mean, for a Zen student, like at least for this one, it was like, that's artificial. That's too saccharine, and, you know, this can't be real. And so I did the reasonable thing, I thought. I just tuned the teachers out when they were doing this guided meditation, and that worked pretty well for me. Until, because 3 months is a long time, about halfway through the retreat, I was just minding my own business, meditating, and lo and behold, this very strange, odd feeling arose inside of me. What's this? I don't know about this. And this is what they're talking about when they do these guided meditations. This is love. This is loving kindness. This is this beautiful feeling of goodwill that is very different than the feeling of compassion. And, oh, that's what it is. So then when they did the guided meditation, oh, this is great. And now I think it's fantastic to do it. And so I wasn't looking for loving kindness. I didn't even want it. I was maybe holding it at a distance. And it found me. And why was that? What is it about Vipassana? For a long time I thought it was because of Vipassana practice is somehow different. But I think lately I think it's because I'd gone through my phase of working with my suffering when I needed compassion. By the time I came to Vipassana, I was ready for a new phase, and the phase for me was a phase of a lot of well-being. I had a lot of joy and well-being and happiness, peace in doing Vipassana. And not initially, but as I went deeper and deeper into it, in a way that I'd never had in Zen. I had degrees of it and times of it, but with Vipassana it was extended periods of great feelings of joy and delight and so one of the byproducts of spending a lot of time feeling really happy and delighted in this practice is delighting in people, feeling kind of happy in people, and seeing the beauty of people, or seeing the preciousness of others, and in that kind of, so not viewing people through the lens of suffering and their suffering, but viewing people through the lens of their of how wonderful people are, and how, and feeling friendly and feeling appreciative and feeling grateful and feeling tremendous goodwill for others. And so at that phase, there was a whole phase where that was kind of a character of kind of what motivated me, where I found myself, when I just loved this idea of goodwill and loved people and delighted in them, and felt, you know, felt all this French friendliness or something that grew and developed. And some of that is because of having this community here at IMC for the last 30 years or so, that the opportunity to get to know people here and know them in a nice way. I just had this, was so many opportunities to just be so appreciative and grateful and kind of see the beauty of people, that it kept kind of feeding this kind of goodwill feeling that was growing in me. And I wasn't trying to do it, but it slowly grew and grew and grew. It was kind of wonderful to see it grow and develop. Or I might have to look back and see how it developed. So that was nice. And then something different happened. And this is kind of the phase maybe that I'm in now. Or maybe I'm due to have this one end and something new will happen. I don't know, the great spans of time. And that was that I started feeling something different. And I still called it compassion, but it had a very different feeling than before. And it started to have this lightness and a sense of ease. In fact, a sense of ease and lightness and peacefulness around this feeling of compassion caused some problems for me, because I thought compassion was supposed to be a kind of empathic pain with the suffering of others. And I felt like, well, I didn't feel it. I felt people's pain. I was cared for it. I was concerned for it. But I found myself feeling kind of at ease in the presence of it. And am I allowed to feel this at ease when people are suffering? People come and tell me tragedies and I feel ease. Is that okay? Shouldn't I be kind of distressed? And then with the social justice movements that have kind of the current last 20 years or so of the trends in that movement, there was kind of an expectation of you should be angry, or and the climate change, you should be distressed, you should be upset. And I certainly cared about all these things, but I just couldn't find myself getting angry or being distressed about all this. Because of this place of kind of this lightness was kind of, it wasn't like a choice. It was like, why would I give it up? Why would I be in a good state that feels healthy and whatever? Why would I give it up for something that feels kind of a little bit like having a wound, wounding myself to do it? Even though maybe there was an expectation, or I had some idea that I was supposed to be different. And so it wasn't so conscious that I was struggling with this, but in retrospect, I saw that I was constantly kind of up against this and working this and kind of trying to navigate this territory between this ease and lightness and peacefulness that I found inside, and how that was supposed to be in the interactions with the people and suffering and the injustice that we find around us in our society. And then what kind of finally clarified for me what I was doing was I was reading the teachings, ancient teachings of the Buddha, and I discovered there there's discussion about karuna, which is compassion, but there's a whole other kind of emotion or attitude or motivation that has gotten very little press in the West, that is actually more important for the Buddha's way in which he cared for the world, taught the world. And that is the term anukampa. And anukampa in some ways is a more humble or simpler or more basic, ordinary caregiving instinct, the caregiving attitude, that clearly in the ancient texts is like how parents care for their kids, how teachers care for their students, people who care for children have this anukampa for their kids in their care. So anukampa was this ordinary feeling, just offering care to people, caring for people. But this was the common way the Buddha operated in the world, was through this anukampa. And it's defined as wanting, working for the welfare and happiness of others. Not working to alleviate suffering for others, but the welfare and happiness. I understand that compassion is a subset of that. When they're suffering, we want to bring that suffering to an end. But a wider scope of care includes also for people who aren't suffering, want them to be well and happy. But more important, what I saw when I started reading about this, that this was a common way in which people had beginning letting go of their clinging, letting go of their attachments, operated in the world in the ancient texts. They operated from this anukampa, this care, and it was an expression of their non-clinging. And I said, oh, I'm no longer centered on compassion. I thought it was. But now I have this other thing called care, anukampa, because now I'm constantly being informed by or guided by the experience of non-clinging, the experience of non-attachment. This is such an important reference point for me. And it's so clear that I'm better off not clinging, better off not being attached than I am being attached. And why would I give up the non-attachment when attachment is a wound, is a form of harm to myself, and maybe sometimes a harm to the world? So I've come to really appreciate this kind of new phase of how to be in the world and care for the world, to care for the world with care, with this, you know, character, you know, supported by this non-clinging aspect. And that also kind of, you know, evolved slowly over time. I didn't see it coming. I didn't plan it. It wasn't what I was expecting at all. So first I was compassionate. Then I was loving-kinded. And now I've been cared. So that was, there's all kinds of other things you could say. I can report about these many years of change. But those kind of stood out to me at Tassajara as I was kind of thinking about and reviewing my life and how all in these 40, 50 years in which I've been involved in Buddhism and the practice. So I hope that this gives you some encouragement that how this practice can work for you. And some of the profound ways, you don't measure the results by the moment or the week or the month. You don't be like a kid in the back of the car who says, are we there yet? Rather, just do the practice. And in what I learned in Zen, if you do the practice, then at some point the practice does you. And then you need to be available for the practice to do you, the practice to practice you. It isn't just you doing it. Because if it was only you doing it, that wouldn't be enough. You have to also get out of the way and be available for something deeper in your heart, in your inner life, to kind of begin working on you. So I hope that was encouraging. And for me, it has been a spectacularly wonderful way of living a life. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. And I'm grateful to be here with you and to share it. Thank you. And it'd be lovely to see all of you, or some of you, at the park. That's about 7 minutes away from here by car. And the Red Morton Park. And there's a small parking lot and a big parking lot at the park. And and that big one, I think, is on Roosevelt. Off Roosevelt, which... And so you probably want to park there. So thank you all.